Okay, this is lesson number 6 on anti-Semitism, causes and effects, a biblical perspective. We started the Middle Ages last week. This week we're going to look at the medieval period, 8th, 9th, and 10th century. And I think next week we are going to, actually I know, next week we are going to look at the Crusades. And so we really already know that next week is not going to be a happy time for the Jewish people. It hasn't been up to now. Right now we're entering a period of time under a dynasty of kings in France that actually were quite friendly to the Jewish people. So in the introduction here, we have... last week we talked about Spain and how bad Spain was to the Jewish people, and they have been pretty steady in their anti-Semitism throughout the ages to until today. Still are on I would say the top five, maybe top five, or definitely the top 10, but the top five countries in Europe, in Western Europe, for anti-Semitism is Spain. In comparison to the status of Jewish people in Spain prior to the Muslim invasion of 711. Jews of France lived relatively trouble-free during the early part of the Middle Ages. The Theodician Code was, of course, a reality in France, but the restrictions that it introduced were not always enforced. Jews were still far from enjoying the freedom of religion that Christians were accustomed to. And the very kind of restrictions that were imposed on Jewish community on the Jewish community at that time showed the unusual closeness of Jews and Christians of France during that era. For instance, Christians were prevented from eating meals with Jews since kosher laws would not allow Jews to reciprocate. So Spain and France did not treat Jews the same way. France, for a time, was better for the Jewish people. France did not really enforce the Theodician Code that was put together by the church fathers and continued to be used rather strictly by countries like Spain. Christians and Jewish relations were closer. Obviously, if an issue is you can eat together because there are some kosher laws and you won't be invited back, that is different from convert or we're going to kill you, or you can't do business, or we need to hit you if you do this, or kill you if you do that. It's the issues are smaller, okay? The common issues of Christian slaves, forced conversions, and forced baptism were still at the forefront of Judeo-Christian relations. And one of the worst cases of forced conversion took place under the leadership of King Dagobert in France, 629-639, who ordered all Jews of the Frankish kingdom to be baptized or leave France. So still you have some of that happening, but I believe that Dagobert was under the dynasty of the Merovingians, which was before the dynasty of the Carolingians, and which is what we're going to be looking at right now. The Jews of France were about to enjoy a short period of respite under the next few kings, and that's the Carolingian respite. Carolingian comes, we can turn the page on the notes here. The Carolingian dynasty, preceded by the Merovingians, was started with the descendants of Charles Martel and got its name from the Latin for Charles, which is Carolus. They reigned from the 700s to the early 1100s. And just about all of those kings where this, you know, the descendants of Charles Martel, and then one after the other, as a king had a son, he was the next king. He had a son, he was the next king. Kind of like in the biblical days, really. And they were all pretty nice to the Jewish people. Charles Martel, if you don't remember, is the king that stopped the Muslims in Poitiers, in France, He stopped the Muslim invasion, the first major Muslim invasion of Europe. He stopped it in the middle of France. So let me give you here the... So there were the descendants of Charles Martel. They reigned from 7 to 1100. Let me give you the four main names that we're going to talk about, and then we'll go on each one chronologically. And I've given you the French names. I'll tell you what they mean in a minute, but because I'm French, I like to use the French names. So Pépin le Bref, 714-768. Charlemagne, this one you've heard before, I'm sure. Louis le Pieux, You've got the dates here, 8:14, 8:40. And Charles Le Chauve, 8:40, 8:77. Now, sometimes they give me, in the date, sometimes I give you the reign, sometimes I give you the death and, you know, birth and date. Obviously, there is an overlap between Pépin le Bref and Charlemagne, but it's not that. The dates are not critical. It gives you an idea of about 170 times, 160 years between like four main kings here. And there are some others in between, but those were the key ones. Pépin le Bref, Bref means short, so Pépin le Bref meant Pépin the Short. They all had names based on their looks. Charlemagne, I'm not quite sure, except that he was a Charles something, and Magne has a meaning of grandeur or importance. Louis le Pieux means Louis the Pious, and Charles le Chauve means Charles the Bald. So now you have what their names mean. Let's take a look a little bit at what they did for or against the Jewish people. Let's see what we have next year. I'll go back to the... There we go. Okay, so under the Carolingian ruling, the laws of the old code of Theodosius were basically forgotten as new, more local legislations were passed, more to protect the church from Jewish customs than to impair the Jews from practicing Judaism. And that's important. Up to this point, the laws of the Theodosian code, even though there were some laws to protect the Jewish people, for the most part, those laws were really created and enforced to impair Jewish people from practicing Judaism. You cannot keep kosher. You cannot worship on the Sabbath. You have to come to a church. You cannot do the Sabbath prayers. You have to attend Easter celebration. You cannot do this. You cannot do that. It was really made to impair Jewish people from practicing Judaism as a whole. Now the laws are changing. The Theodosian Code is not null and void. It's still very much a reality, but it's not used a whole lot. And the laws are just to protect church members, Christians, so to speak, from becoming enamored with Judaism and converting to Judaism, if that would be the case, because then the church would lose some of its members. So it was more more laws of that nature to protect Christians and Christianity more than to impair Jews from practicing Judaism. And this was starting to happen with the first king being Pépin the Bref, 714-768, and only improved under Charlemagne. Charlemagne was probably one of the main, the biggest friends of Jewish people in mid-700, early 800. Jewish people in his court, in his cabinet, so to speak, or his court, they included Jewish people, and they were all well-treated. And he found no difficulties in reconciling the two, in preserving the growth and well-being of the church while maintaining a good relationship with the Jewish community of the Frankish kingdom. He had no problem with that. As a matter of fact, I think I might have mentioned that last week. Charlemagne had at one time in his reign, he was a crown emperor in 800. That's one of the dates that we learn very, very young in France. In French history that you never forget. You know, Charlemagne is 800, Napoleon is 1804, which is the dates that you die remembering, you know, because they drill them in you, at least in my generation. I don't know about today anymore. But Charlemagne sent a delegation of four men to the Far East, like they did a lot in those days, delegates and representative of kingdoms, and they would come bearing gifts, and they would exchange gifts and discuss treaties and different, you know, things of the sort. And of the four men, three died and one survived. That was a Jewish one who survived. Why, we don't know. This is not important to the story. But the fun part of it is that he came back to Emperor Charlemagne, and he brought back with him a gift that nobody had ever seen, I think, in all of Europe, but most certainly in France. He brought back an elephant. That was the gift that he brought back, a live elephant. So it must have taken him a while to come back, but he brought back an elephant. And it's in, you know, in the, if you do a little research in the history books and sort, you read this Jewish man coming back from a diplomatic trip and bringing back an elephant to France. So this has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, but I like the story. So Charlemagne was already a really good friend of the Jews. And it continued under his son and successor, Louis the Pious, 814-840, whose wife admired Judaism. This was the first time in the whole of Christendom that Jewish people were treated fairly and even highly respected by Christians. This allowed them to acquire property and wealth and expand demographically within the kingdom. Jews were able to hold important positions within the state. They were appreciated as merchants, valued as doctors. Louis the Pious, as a matter of fact, had his own Jewish physician. And he was not the only one. Many of the kings of Europe, not just France, had Jewish physicians. He also provided Jews with diplomas and letters of protection. Now, here we have a time where Jewish people live in relative peace in Europe, in France at least. So they grow, you know, demographically. They're not being killed, they're not being raped, they're not being destroyed. So they grow demographically, they grow, you know, they acquire wealth, they acquire property, they socially expand, professionally they expand. Eventually, it's going to get to a place where some of the kings down the road are going to go like, whoa, what's going on with the Jews here? Just like the Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. Same story. We have Jewish people that, when you think about the Jewish people back in Exodus, why did God take 70 Jewish people and put them in slavery for 400 years? I always look at this as when God closes the door on something, we always go, oh, well, God closed the door, so I can't get to do that. Sometimes God closes the door on you to protect you from doing something that he wouldn't want you to do, and you're protected from him, and you're within the closed doors, you're not always on the outside. And it's the same thing when he took the 70 Jews and took them to Egypt. That was to make the nation of Israel, to protect them, I think, and to let them come out 400 years later, 2 million strong, and the rest of the story is in the Bible. Here, we have a time where somehow the Jewish people were allowed to grow, and of course it didn't last very long, but for the time that it lasted, it made an impact on society, and it got to the place where some of the kings started to worry about the Jewish growth, and then they're acquiring property and doing business, and so that is eventually going to change. And out of that time, right after that time, all the big lies that are still used to an extent by the Muslim world today kind of took place. The greedy Jew came out of that time. The blood libel about Jews using Christian children to the blood of Christian children to make matzah for Passover came out of that time. A little later, the poisoning of the wells of Europe for the Black Plague came out of that time. You know, all those things came out of that after they had a chance to grow because of that period of respite. So, but we are in that period right now, and they're growing, and they are being protected. Yet, for a Jewish doctor, there was still some risk. A Jewish person being a doctor, when a patient would lose his life, his or her life, the Jewish doctor would still be accused of sorcery and or poisoning in the case of Charles the Bald or Hugues Capet, as we call him in France, in the 800s and 900s. Who apparently died at the hands of Jewish physicians, and of course, quickly, the Jews were responsible. Louis the Pious also appointed a person, or it's uncertain if he was a Jew or not, but he was known as a Magister Judaeorum, or Master of the Jews, that's Latin for Master of the Jews, and it was a person in charge of Jewish affairs and responsible for their safety and fair treatment. Under Louis the Pious, the murder, now listen to this, this is quite a departure from what we've heard in the last couple of weeks. Murder of a Jew was fined the humongous amount of 10 pounds of gold. Back in the days, this is not a small amount, okay? Even today, I'd like to have 10 pounds of gold in my house, okay? Especially today, I'd like to have 10 pounds of gold in my house. The emperor also allowed Jewish slave owners to refuse their slaves permission to be baptized. So it goes without saying that this did not sit very well with the church, and it if not officially, behind the scenes, definitely riots and harassment and whatnot continue to happen behind the scene. Now, Saint Agobar, Archbishop of Lyon, or Lyon, France, spent 2 decades fighting the emperor in trying to revoke some of Louis the Pious, some of his laws. He even unsuccessfully called for the reversion of the Theodician Code, and he ended up writing several long letters to the other churchmen of France in which he covered the entire scope of anti-Jewish rhetoric in hope to put a stop to what appeared to him as the emperor's favoritism towards the Jews. Before I read you some of an excerpt of one of his letters, we have to understand something is a lot of that history of early, the Dark Ages and then the Middle Ages, we have church and state fighting for power back and forth. Church and state will mesh together and work together. Sometimes they would split, work against each other, and then whoever gets in the middle gets hurt. But for the most part, the church always ended up controlling the state, at the very least, working with and controlling from behind. Here, it appears that the state or the emperors or the kings would, for 200 or 300 years, have a little bit more of the upper hand, so they would not look at the Jewish people with so much disdain. The church members, the bishops and the archbishops and the popes, always had a backdrop of false understanding of biblical Christianity and false understanding of Scripture that they applied to their interpretation of who a Jew is. And they always, as much as they wanted to be the friends of the Jews, they always had this, but they killed Christ, in the back of their head. Not so much the emperors and the kings. Sometimes they had no choice. They had less power than the church, and they had to gain power and property and to rule their kingdoms. They had to go along with what the church said. But at this time, it appears that the emperor or emperors and kings would have a little more of the upper hand. But it didn't stop the churchmen from writing quite some abrasive statements and letters and encyclicals against the Jews, reminiscent of some of what Chrysostom wrote in his writing in a Church Fathers. Here is somebody mentioned in the early class today that this quote almost sounds like one of the hymns that we sing, that some of us might have done singing in church about the enemy, here, of course, the enemy is the Jews. Jews are cursed and covered with malediction as by a cloak. The malediction has penetrated them as water in their entrails and oil in their bones. They are cursed in the city and cursed in the country, cursed in their coming and in their going out. Cursed is the fruit of their loins, of their lands, of their flocks. Cursed their cellars, their granaries, their shops, their food, and the crumbs of their tables. So this is what Archbishop of Lyon, Saint Agobar, wrote to other churchmen to try to entice them, to try to kind of gather some support to put an end to this favoritism that the Kingdom of France was apparently giving to the Jews. And it covers everything, basically, what they do, what they eat, what they, you know, cellars, wine, granaries, you know, grain, shops, their food, their flocks. It covers everything, you know, basically everything that a Jew does or touches or is cursed. That's what he was trying to say. Charles the Bald, 840-877, the son of Louis the Pious, was even nicer to Jewish people. So as some of the church people tried to put a stop to it, the kings and the emperors continued to be nice to the Jewish people for a little while longer. Charles the Bald actually taxed the Jewish people slightly less than the non-Jewish merchants. As this next king got nicer to the Jewish community, Bishop Amulo, 841-852, actually strengthened the grip on the Jews a little tighter. Again, you've got state and church fighting over how to handle the Jewish community. And of course, in the meantime, the Jews are in the middle. So, you know, we're caught in the middle. He was involved in the Council of Meaux, which is in the east side of Paris, between Paris and the German border, trying to reinstate much of the Theodician codes the laws of the code, the Theodician code against the Jews, Charles the Bold dissolved the council. It reconvened in Paris in 846, just a year later, but this time without the anti-Jewish laws. Amulot contributed to the chronicles of anti-Jewish diatribes by sending his letter to the emperor, and it was more like a little booklet called Liber Contra Judeos, a book against the Jews. I mean, at least he's clear in the title. He's not like trying to, like today you see some of the anti-Semitic propaganda. The world is not really understanding that it's anti-Semitic because it's not clear. The titles are kind of, you could understand the opposite. It's misleading. But here, the book against the Jews, it says on the cover what it means. Using every method possible, lies and or misinterpretation of scriptures to perform more character assassination against the Jews, is contra Judeos is, if not new, in a never-ending series of anti-Semitic writings, certainly continued to pave the way on the road to the total annihilation of the Jewish people. It was just one more stepping stone towards the final solution of the Holocaust. Coming down the road. Charles the Bold was the last of the Carolingian king to look upon the Jews rather favorably. Jews who had been rather involved in agriculture up to now will see a decline in their abilities to sustain their communities through the fruit of their land. Very soon, commerce and banking will become their new mode of operation. Have I shared with you about why Jewish people are, why there is a stereotype of the greedy Jew? Have I shared that before? You know, people say, well, Jews are greedy. You've heard that before, right? Who hasn't heard, Jews are greedy? Who hasn't heard, he Jewed me down? When people try to bargain with somebody and they say, well, he Jewed me down, because Jews are greedy. Jews love money. Do you know where this comes from? It comes from that period of time in the Middle Ages where apparently some of the kings here, this last king, Louis the Pious, actually, is it Louis the Pious or Charles the Bold? You think, I remember, there's so many. Charles the Bold taxed them slightly less. But this is what happened. Jewish people, a lot of them, it started towards the end of that period. It started where Jewish people, again, could not own property, be part of a guild, or the feudal system started to develop really big at that time, and Jewish people could not be part of that so much. So they ended up being... they became lawyers and doctors. It started to happen already because there's something that they could take with them when they would be kicked from one country to the next. You take your knowledge with you. You don't have to take property or tools or any materials or stock or anything. You just take your knowledge with you. Back then, a doctor was purely knowledge, very few tools, and a lawyer, the same thing. So they could take that from place to place. And Jews always like to study, so put the two together, you get some really good doctors, really good lawyers, and it continued to this day. But the greedy Jew came out of that period of time where Jews ended up only being able to loan money because it was forbidden for Christian under the church to loan money at an interest rate. So Christians couldn't do it, but Christians wanted to borrow money. That was not against Christianity. You could not loan with interest, but you can borrow money. So they went to the Jews. And we'll do it in dollars. We'll say, this Christian comes to this Jewish man and say, I need to borrow $10, I'll pay you back in a month. So they would get $10 from this Jewish man, and they come back in a month, and they give him back $10.50 or $11. And then Jewish people have to pay a tax to the kingdom of 25 cents on the interest. So they made 75 cents. Well, it went on for a while. And then the kings, except for the few of the Carolingians of that period, the kings looked at that and went like, wait a minute here. There's instant money for us to make. We can tax the Jews. They're doing banking. We're going to tax them. So now they say, for every dollar that you loan, we will take 75 cents on the interest. So, and of course I'm using fictitious numbers, but it's a principle I'm trying to explain. So now they give $10 to this Christian, he comes back and he gives 11, and they get 75 to the king, and they only make 25 cents, you get 11 25 cents. So all of a sudden they tell the Christian, it's 11.50. Because they're forced to raise their interest rate so they can make a little more money to live. Because the kings are taxing them. And the kings keep taxing and overtaxing and overtaxing to the point where they're never making barely any money. So they end up having outrageous interest rate to make a dollar. And out of that, we got the greedy Jew. This is where it comes from. A Jew always wants to make more money. And then, of course, he got developed into this greedy Jew concept and this, you know, and Jews love money. And Jewish people are good in business. So couple being good in business with being greedy, which we're not, of course. But then you get that. But this is where it came from. Being forced to charge more interest because we were taxed more than we could afford on the interest that we were making on the money that we were lending. So this is where it came from. Now, the calm before the storm. There's always a calm before the storm. Any questions up to now? Okay. What do we have here? Okay, so while the 9th century was certainly not the most violent against the Jewish people, hardship were not a thing of the past, and a very bleak future was looming around the corner as the next millennia was approaching. During the 9th century, Jews were regularly accused of treason by Christians. That was one of the big accusation. And a custom was developed that on Good Friday, which had nothing, there was nothing good about Friday for the Jewish people, each Jew must receive a blow on the face, a price to pay for having crucified the Lord. This would continue as a Christian custom for 300 years. So on Good Friday, Jewish people probably were hiding somewhere. Because if you were found anywhere, I did not put it in the notes, but what they would actually do is they developed it, they built those mallets, the big hammers that they would use for Jews. They would just have this hammer that would be just for, you know, where's my Jew? I can hit him in the face. It's a Christian thing to do. It's the price they have to pay for crucifying our Lord. Of course, the Jews did not crucify the Lord, but that's what would happen at that time. So, in the midst of all that quiet time, it's starting to, you know, the calm is there, but then we're starting to see some weird things happening, and it always has something to do with a Christian misconception that the Jews are responsible for the death of Jesus. But it continued for 300 years, which, you know, it's amazing that this custom of hitting a Jew on Good Friday, probably for good luck or something, continued for 300 years. The 10th century records less anti-Semitic events than previous centuries. The gospel was preached to the Jewish community with a disclaimer that if they did not convert, they should be expelled. And that they experienced quite a bit. Jewish people, you know, the concept of the wandering Jew from one country to the next. My family was all in Russia and Lithuania and Poland. They came to France in the late 1800s. And of course, had we had a chance, or if it wasn't God's plan, we would have, all of us, come to America. One day I'll tell you the story of my great-grandfather who came to New York but didn't stay. But maybe all of us would have been in America by now. But so the Jewish people move a lot when it's not safe in one country, or if they're asked to leave, like it was in the case in 1492 when Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It was in the midst of a massive exodus of Jewish people out of Spain. And we'll get to there in a few weeks. So convert, or you can leave, which is still better than what happened in the Inquisition, convert or die. Okay, we're not quite there yet. So France turned out to be a quieter place for the Jewish community to flourish as Spain remained on the forefront of anti-Semitism. And to this day, Spain is, a country that's very anti-Semitic. So we have all those things. Physical harm becomes common, conversion or expulsion, and now, while the latter part of the first millennia was not without incident in Jewish history, 9th and 10th centuries ended up being a period of relative respite, placed between the early centuries of anti-Jewish theological tirades by myriad of church fathers and the upcoming dark hour of the Crusades and the Inquisition. So we have this short period where Jewish people were able to grow and prosper a little more. It's probably, if you ask any Jewish person who's familiar with Jewish history, they would tell you this is probably one of the periods where Jewish people had, you know, it was a better time for the Jewish community of Europe. Now, in that period of time, several key Jewish players were born, and we need to be aware of them. They're Jewish thinkers and philosophers and rabbis and doctors. What does it have to do with anti-Semitism? Well, actually, it has some to do with anti-Semitism because they contributed to the reinterpretation of the Bible, not to lose too many Jewish people as they would convert to Christianity. And as you'll see in a minute, I'll tell you exactly what they did. But these people, these three people I'm going to mention to you, are to this day considered pillars of Judaism, and anybody studying the Jewish people, Israel, or anti-Semitism should know about these men. So they are some of the greatest Jewish minds that were born and contributed to Jewish history in ways that still exist well into the 21st century. And among many contributors to the advancement of mankind in general and Jewish life in particular were two major thinkers, three actually. I added one in the PowerPoint that is not in the notes, so you might have to write a few words. Moses Maimonides, who was born in Spain, and Rashi, who was born in France. Now, Maimonides, Rashi, and the third one, who his name is Abraham ibn Ezra, all were contemporaries of one another. But I started with Moses and Maimonides because we talked about Spain last week, and I wanted to start with Spain as well. So Moses Maimonides, now each of these men, it's very common for Jewish rabbis, famous Jewish rabbis, to be called by an acronym. They're not called Rabbi Olivier Melnick or Rabbi Bob Morris. They're called like R and O L for Olivier, L M E for Melnick. So it will be Rabbi. My nickname will be Rolme. It sounds weird, but when you see that Rabbi Moses ben Mammon or Maimonides, also known by the acronym Rambam. You talk to anybody, any Jewish religious person who studies Judaism, and you tell them, do you know Rambam? And they obviously immediately will know you're talking about Moses Maimonides. Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Mammon. Out of that, you get an acronym, Rambam. Rashi is Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzhak. Rashi. Shlomo ben Yitzhak. Rashi. And you've heard of Rashi, I'm sure. Okay, so they get those names, those acronyms. And Rabbi Moses Maimonides, 1135-1204, born in Cordoba, Spain, he contributed several things. One of the first things that I wanted to tell you about was Mishneh Torah, meaning the repetition of the Torah, that continues to carry authority as a codification of Talmudic law to this day. He did this 14-volume body of work just to do a greater explanation of the Torah, 14 volumes just on the five books of Moses. And of course, he also is the author of, I love the title of this book, The Guide to the Perplexed. I have a copy of The Guide to the Perplexed at home on my shelf. And every time I open it, I get more perplexed. It's quite confusing, but according to Rambam, he wrote it to promote the true understanding of the real spirit of the law, to guide those religious persons who, adhering to the Torah, have studied philosophy and are embarrassed by the contradictions between the teaching of philosophy and the literal sense of Torah. So this is, it starts with a good principle. He wants to help Jewish people understand the Torah better, so he wrote this guide to the perplexed. Rambam is also remembered for having contributed his famous 13 principles of faith to the Jewish community of his time. Even though they were first criticized by many, they have been adopted. They became widely accepted and are still considered today the cornerstone of Jewish religious life around the world. 13 principles of faith. I'm going to read them to you because we agree with a lot of it. You're going to see as believers in Yeshua, you read this and you go like, yeah, I can agree with that, a lot of it. It's quite interesting. What is said about him, his name was Moses Maimonides, and you know, Jewish people came up with this one little sentence about Rambam that really is, you know, it's quite something. It says, from Moses to Moses, there were none like Moses. So that's like, you know, if you don't get a big head with that, from the Moses of the wilderness who took that, you know, took, let my people go, you know, like the Moses of the wilderness to Moses Maimonides, there were none like Moses of this Moses. So it's putting him on equal footing with Moses. And of course, if that's true, then maybe what he says is inspired. They're not saying that, but it's pretty close. So he gave us the 13 principles of faith, and really they're quite interesting. Each one starts with, I believe, with perfect faith. It talks about the Messiah in there. It talks about, this is the Jewish manifesto to this day. A religious Jew, if you ask him, have you read the 13 principles of faith of Rambam, they can look at you and it's like you're asking them, have you heard the Pledge of Allegiance as an American? And they're going to go like, of course, I recite it whenever I'm asked to, whenever I can. And so this is that important. And this is what it says. I mean, it's that important to the Jewish community, the Jewish people, the religious Jewish people. If you ask me, until I start studying Judaism and Jewish religious thought at Moody Bible Institute, and I was interested in all that, I was raised a secular Jew, never heard of Rambam, and I never heard of the 13 principle of faith, because I was not religious. I was not studying in a yeshiva. I was not speaking Hebrew. Yes?
So this 14th volume and the 13 principles would be in there, I'm assuming, is what
you
hear today talking about the Mishnah?
No, the Mishnah is a commentary on the oral law. There's a belief within Judaism that when Moses was given the 613 mitzvot, the 613 commandments by God, 10 of them being written by the hand of God on the tablets of stone, there's a belief in the Jewish community that when Moses received the written law, the Torah means law, he also received the oral law. God gave him a set to write down and an extra set that he was going to pass down, you know, from person to person, from, you know, word of mouth. And so that oral law has never been found or written or from the days of Moses or but because there is this tradition, what happened is that we're kind of going on a little bit of a parallel here, but it's important. Jewish people started building a fence around the law, and then a fence around the fence, and then a fence around the fence. And they got to the place after several centuries that they had to justify all those additional laws. There's like hundreds of laws on you shall not boil a baby in its mother's milk. And one day I can explain to you where it came from and how it departed from the real meaning. So to really justify all those laws that were starting from a good principle, don't break Torah. Don't break the Torah. Don't break the law. So we have to protect the Torah. If the Torah says we shouldn't go through that door, maybe we shouldn't even have a door there. So let's just close it. And then somebody's going to go like, okay, but what if somebody opens it by mistake? You're right. We're going to put a piece of wood with some nails. So now they put the door, which was made for in and out, now it's closed, but it's closed with a piece of wood with some nails. But what if somebody one day comes with the tools and they don't know it's supposed to be closed, but they have the tools to take the nails off? You're right. So we have to put something over the nails so the nails cannot be taken. And on, and on. That's building a fence around. Originally, that's so that somebody would not go through the door by mistake when not supposed to. Just an example, okay? That's what happens. I don't even know where I'm doing all this. Bring me back to where I was when you... Oh, the Mishnah. Okay. So, see, this is dangerous, and you get me off track here. It's dangerous, dangerous. Okay. So, the Mishnah is a commentary on the oral law. Okay. The Mishnah and the Gemara are two different sets of commentaries and stories about the oral law. And when you put all the Mishnah and all the Gemara together, you get what's known as the Talmud. It's a compendium of Mishnah and Gemara put together. You get the Talmud. And then you get commentaries on the Talmud. Okay? Talmud is not the Word of God, okay? It's a commentary on the oral law that supposedly Jewish people got through Moses but it was not written. So there's no proof of it. And really what it is, it's a justification for closing the door and putting the nails, okay? I mean, that's an analogy here. Okay, so the 13th principle of faith. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, is the Creator and guide of everything that has been created. He alone has made, does make, and will make all things. So far, so good. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, is one, and that there is no unity in any manner like His, and that He alone is our God, who was and is and will be. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, has no body, and that He is free from all the properties of matter, and that there can be no physical comparison to Him whatsoever. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, is the first and the last. I believe that the perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, and to Him alone is a right to pray, and that there is no right to pray to any being besides Him. I believe with perfect faith that all the words of the prophets are true. Interesting. If that's really true, then the prophets talked about the coming Messiah. But, you know, that's I find that to be very interesting. I believe with perfect faith that the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, peace be upon him, was true, and that he was the chief of the prophets, both those who preceded him and those who followed him. I believe with perfect faith that the entire Torah that is now in our possession is the same that was given to Moses, our teacher, peace be upon him. I believe with perfect faith that this Torah will not be exchanged, and that there will never be another Torah from the Creator, blessed be his name. Those are some things that we not necessarily fully agree with. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, knows all the deeds of human beings and all their thoughts, as it is written, who fashioned the hearts of them all, who comprehends all their actions, Psalm 33:15. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, rewards those who keep His commandments and punishes those who transgresses them. I like number 12. I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah, and even though he may tarry, nonetheless I wait every day for His coming. I believe with perfect faith that there will be a revival of the dead at the time when it shall please the Creator, blessed be His name, and His mention shall be exalted forever and ever. A lot of it, all of us would go like, this is good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's a couple of things where, you know, we might disagree with the way he says it. But, you know, I would like, you know, to talk to Jewish people and say, well, you know, are you familiar with the 13 principles of faith? Well, sure. Well, what's the number 6? Of course, it's most likely they wouldn't remember. Neither would I. Probably would have to have a listing. Although, in this case, I would remember. I believe with perfect faith that all the words of the prophets are true. Is that true? Of course. Well, then let's go back to the prophets. And let's look at the words of the prophets. And let's study messianic prophecies one by one. If you can use Jewish logic in your witnessing to Jewish people, then you might still receive disagreement and complaint from the person you're talking to, but they go home, you've planted a seed of doubt. They're going to go like, wait a minute, I'm not being honest with myself, definitely not being honest with that person, but I'm not being honest with myself, because if I believe that the words of the prophet are true, then the next thing they would go like, well, maybe we have a different interpretation of what the words is, but you know, I know there's truth, but we don't agree on what the truth is. So then you have to really go back and study a little more. But that's an interesting 13 principle of faith here that Moses Maimonides provided. All religious Jews are very familiar with those principles, as well as the Guide to the Perplexed in Mishneh Torah. Now, Rashi, the French people, our contribution to the famous rabbis, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, born in 1040, died in 1105. The First Crusade was in 1096. Rashi lived through the First Crusade. And this is very important to remember, because Rashi changed the meaning of messianic prophecies forever. Messianic prophecies of the Old Testament, of the Tanakh, up to the time of Rashi, meant the coming of a Messiah. Now, people might not know who the Messiah was, but you read the writings of all the rabbis up to Rashi, they all agreed that Genesis 49:10, Isaiah 7:14, Isaiah 53, Isaiah 9:6 and 7, all talk about the coming of the Messiah. They all had messianic implications. We're not sure who it is, but this is It cannot be anybody but the Redeemer, the Messiah. Rashi saw this as a major threat on the Jewish community because all these messianic prophecies, it's really circular reasoning, all these messianic prophecies, they seem to point to Jesus. And it's just not going to work for us. So now we have to point the people to a different interpretation. And from Rashi on to this day, all the messianic prophecies point to the land and country of Israel and the Jewish people. If you take the Hebrew and you translate it literally, especially in Isaiah 53, there's the we and the us and the he and all the pronouns cannot possibly talk about Israel. But the Jewish people to this day believe that since Rashi changed the interpretation and he was such an influence on Jewish life and on Jewish theology, that it has been unchanged and unchallenged, except by a few people that would challenge it, and they probably end up becoming believers in followers of Yeshua. So what did Rashi contribute to the Jewish world and, you know, to the world in general, because this is used by more than just Jewish people? Commentary on the Torah. He did a commentary on, let me read the notes here, known as, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, medieval French rabbi, famous for the first comprehensive commentary on the Talmud. He also did a commentary on the Torah and on the Old Testament. Within worldwide Judaism, he is considered as the foremost commentator, so much so that no religious Jews today would consider studying Torah or Talmud without his commentaries. They are included in every edition of the Talmud since 1520. Rashi's commentaries since 1520. He uses the approach known as literal basic interpretation. If you remember, in the first couple of lessons, we talked about Peshat, and I put those notes back here on the top of the last page. Peshat is a plain, simple, or direct meaning of the text. So he uses an interpretation that is plain, simple, direct, which, of course, he's not being honest with himself when he changes some of the interpretation of the messianic prophecies. But there is a certain anti-Christian reaction here that forces him to do what he did. Now, his commentary on the Torah, commentary on the Talmud, Peshat interpretation, Rashi is still the measuring stick in Talmudic studies today. So much so that when you compare him, when Jewish people study the Talmud, they cannot study without the notes by Rashi. They're lost without it. When they study the Tanakh, because he did the commentary on the Torah, on the first five books, he did a commentary on the entire Old Testament, and he did a commentary on the Talmud. It's an extensive amount of work that he did in his lifetime. And I want to show you a page of the Talmud here. It was a page of the Talmud. And to give you an idea, I'm going to put those four little titles here, and let me explain something to give you an idea of the influence of Rashi to this day. What page it is, it doesn't matter. It's got, you know, so many, like 14 or 18 volumes, and it's huge. But here, on this part here, called the Tosafot, means the additions. It's a series of little notes and commentaries by famous, important rabbis, not like Rashi, not like Maimonides. They might quote Maimonides. It's a, you know, Rabbi Melnick said that Rabbi Morris said that Maimonides disagreed with Nachmanides about the issue of purity in this and that. And then the other line is, yes, but when Rabbi Morris was quoting Rabbi Melnick, he forgot to mention that Rabbi Melnick was also quoting Rabbi Ben Yehuda. That's days and days of reading of that kind of stuff. You read a page, you can really get lost in it, okay? It's not easy reading. Really not easy reading. But the point is, all this are notes from many different commentators and rabbis. Okay? That's the Tosafot, the additions. Then here, in the middle, I should have started with this really, is the passage of the Talmud. Here, other commentaries and notes right here, and actually right here as well. Additional notes in the margin. And here, I colorized it for you, is Rashi's commentary. And it's not necessarily that short. It could get all the way down to here sometimes. Rashi is anywhere from 25 to 30% of each single page of the Talmud. Here you can have 20 or 30 different names cited. Here you have one person. Now what's amazing is that this is not even the Bible. This is the Talmud. This is a commentary on the oral law that was given, quote-unquote, to Moses when he was given the law. So it might quote some verses of the Bible to discuss them in the Talmud. Then Rashi says what they really mean when they make a commentary on the verse of the Bible is this. So you're at least twice, if not three times, removed from the original word of God. Offense around offense around offense. And then on top of that, you got all the other commentaries here. Not to mention what's known as the super commentaries, which is the additional volumes written to make commentaries on all this. We love to argue. Jewish people love to argue. You put two Jews in a room, you get three opinions. We love to argue. he was a student of the Word. I mean, I took a class at Moody. Actually, it was a class that we kind of made up. A senior seminar class when we took a, you know, the Rashi's writing. So I did. I'd study some commentaries in the Book of Genesis, and we had to write papers, and it was fun up to a time, and then it became really. It was hard, but. He did commentaries verse by verse, you know, and a lot of what he says is a lot of value, but he has an agenda. His agenda is clearly anti-Christian, to protect the Jewish people, not because he hates the Christians, but because he wants to protect the Jewish community. And he was a great student of the Word, and he probably knew Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic in those days, and he contributed at a time where there's not that many other people contributing at that level. So he became famous, and then, it started being used, and he became he's the pillar in Jewish religious thought to this day. Sure, but it's not cool to disagree with Rashi. But there are evil people that disagree with him right there. There were two schools in the days of Jesus, Hillel and Shammai, the two rabbis, and they were like they have a conservative and a liberal kinda. Okay, they disagreed all the time. Sometimes one was right, the other one was not. You know, but there's this joke about this great rabbi, and he's got two disciples in the yeshiva, and one disciple goes. Rebbe, it's a title of honor you call the rabbi. Rebbe, it's a Rebbe. He says that according to this, this is what that means. And he goes, he's right. And then he goes, but I say that according to that, this is what that means. And the Rebbe goes, you're right. And the two disciples look at each other and they go, whoa, wait a minute. We cannot both be right. And then Rebbe looks at both of them and goes, you're right. That's Jewish thinking at its best. That is Jewish thinking at its best, okay? So this is a good summary of a page of the Talmud right there. Not that the Talmud, I'm not saying it's not good. It's just like you have to spend a tremendous amount of time to decipher how much of it you can really use beyond what already we have in the scripture. Historically, the social life of the time, the history of the time, you get some great great insight on Jewish thinking, Jewish life, but it's complicated. It's very complicated. A group of rabbis, I believe known as the Tanaim, the scribes, back in the days of Ezra. And then there's three different groups that build the fence around the fence around the fence. So a group of rabbi codified, wrote all what they remember as the oral law. And then another group of rabbis said, well, this is good, but what if? And then another group, hundreds of years later, said, this is good, but what if? And so they kept building the fences to the point where we have this body of law explaining the oral law, which, of course, nobody has a copy of because it's oral. started at that time, to be codified, to be written. Right. And it took 800 years. Back in the land. Well, actually, no. There's two Talmuds. Sorry, there's the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. The Bavli is a Talmud that started to be written in Babylon, the Babylonian Talmud. And then there is a Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi Talmud. And the only one that is completed is the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud is not complete and never will be. But the Babylonian Talmud, it's not Babylonian in the sense that it has Babylon influence. It's just where it was written. You know, it started during the captivity. Okay? God only knows. You're both right. let me, we're done with the notes, so I'm going to stop the recording here.